Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Esports was a growing prospect before the pandemic. Robert Morris University of Illinois was the first college to offer esports scholarships in 2014. This year, 6 years later, there are 170 member schools in the National Association of Collegiate Esports and scores more college-based clubs and college social esports programs. And when COVID-19 sidelined athletic sports, esports carried on, enjoying expanded visibility on ESPN and Fox Sports. Nathan Meeker is director of the University of Akron Esports Program, where the Rocket League team has won three consecutive national titles. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you, Ann. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. Don Marinelli wrote about esports in the pandemic for Slate last month. He is the director of innovation for InVen Global, the English language version of South Korea's largest game media company, which covers the esports industry. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Don, how would you quantify the popularity of esports compared to more traditional sports like football? Is there anything, is there a graph that you can describe in your mind?
Well, I think you have to take a look at the demographics. I mean, the demographics for esports really indicates that among the digital native generation, it is, in fact, the sport of preference. So in that regard, it has an upward trajectory in terms of its appeal. I mean, sadly, those of us who are boomers are watching the traditional sports person just sort of like die out. And esports is definitely dominating.
You think it'll replace?
I think that in terms of this particular demographic, it is in fact going to continue its ascendancy. They're not going to lose interest in it. I kind of liken it to when I was young and we were totally into rock and roll. You know, we were told it was going to be a fad. Mm-hmm. And yet I can now walk into a retail store and see 19-year-olds singing Stairway to Heaven, which is, you know, almost 60 years old. No, I don't think it's going away. I think it will supplant many of the traditional sports.
Nathan Meeker, at the University of Akron, your program started in 2017. You have 1,600 people applying a year for it. What's that been like?
So it's been a pretty wild ride over the past couple of years. I didn't necessarily expect to see quite that many apply, and that's 1,600 when we're really only opening up 5 to 10 spots on the varsity team per year. But we're also doing the club and the recreational level, so you're seeing about 10 to 15% of the campus engage in gaming or esports in some level or another at Akron.
What kind of adjustments have you made because of the pandemic at University of Akron?
So we've done a lot of work within the spaces for students who need to come in and to use our physical facilities to practice out of or compete out of. So we do have recommendations in place for all of our varsity teams as well as our club teams that they're expected to play from home if possible, but we can make accommodations for those where it's not possible. So we've got social distancing stations set up where they're way more than 6 feet apart, and then we're instituting our cleaning routines, students are wearing masks, and then they're letting us know who is going to be there and if there is a particular team that will be in the facilities during the time that we're practicing, then we make sure that it's only that one particular team so we can clean up appropriately afterwards. The competition side's changed quite a bit. There's no in-person competitions for any of the teams this year. However, all of the online competitions are still going strong and we're still competing for a normal audience online.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we are talking about esports in the age of COVID-19. You just heard Nathan Meeker. He's director of esports at the University of Akron. And also with us, Don Marinelli. He's visiting professor at Arizona State, and he wrote about esports in the pandemic in Slate last month. Don Marinelli, it took me a few minutes to wrap my brain around the idea of esports years ago, And I get it. I mean, everybody knows gamers, and I get the gaming of it. What I didn't get was the audience part of it, that there would be actually an audience. And of course, Twitch came along and there were all of these opportunities for people to watch remotely, which then when I thought about pandemic, about COVID-19, I thought, well, you know, nothing's bad. I mean, this is a match made in heaven. But there was a really big growing movement of live audience, not participation, but watching. And that's been hit hard, right?
Oh, it's been hit major. But to give the audience some idea of what we're talking about,
yeah.
when the League of Legends finals was held at the Staples Center, I think it was 2015 or 16, it featured two Korean teams. It was South Korea Telecom versus Samsung Galaxy, and it was held at the Staples Center on the same day as the LA Comic-Con. And what the audience needs to appreciate is it sold out. It was the fastest sellout in the history of Ticketmaster. It was also it sold out faster than anything at the Staples Center. And I keep reminding people that's where the Lakers play.
Right, right. That's the big place.
That's the big place. And 19,000, you know, fanatic fans there. And I just, you know, I sat there just aghast. I mean, I was like, holy mackerel, there is a subculture that is rapidly becoming a dominant culture here. So, and then the other thing to keep in mind is that at the finals in Katowice, Poland, I mean, how many of us have ever heard of Katowice, Poland?
Mm-hmm.
Last year when they had their European Championship, 174,000 people showed up over the three-day event. That shows you the level of dedication that fans of esports have.
So has esports been that harmed by COVID-19 social distancing restrictions?
Well, I mean, as you heard, there are no in-person events
right.
that are being held this year. But fortunately, you can get your fix online. And that goes back to, you mentioned Twitch. Twitch is a phenomenon in and of itself.
Yeah,
you know, I point out to people that, remember, Amazon bought Twitch for $970 million at a time when Twitch made no money.
Right.
And, you know, it comes down to, well, why would they buy that? And it's called, well, it's eyeballs. You know, Amazon, which is about selling, realized that, gee, here was a platform by which they could reach a rising demographic, which is more than eager to spend money on esports, but also as they grow and become more mature and more and earn more money, they're going to be the target demographic.
You know, Nathan Meeker, when you hear those kind of numbers like the Staples Center selling out, you know, faster than anything in Ticketmaster history, having 1,600 people applying a year for 5 or 10 slots on your varsity team, it doesn't sound that weird. But I'm wondering, how do you promote individuals in the esports world? How do they try out?
Sure. So a lot of it works very similarly to traditional sports. If you look at D1, D2, D3 college schools, where you typically will have walk-on tryouts for some of these different teams. And that works very similarly to esports. We are aware of the applicants that are going to be trying out. We effectively get to see an online portfolio that demonstrates some of the play that they did while they were in high school, maybe some that they did on their own, some highlight reels, different statistics, and then we either bring them in, or this year, obviously, it's going to be online, but we do the tryouts against other folks that are also trying out and effectively run a boot camp, if you will, where we get students to come in over the course of a weekend and have them try out for those different slots on those different teams. Just like with traditional sports, on a lot of these teams, there are positions that they're trying out for. So they're not just trying out for a general spot on the team. They're mm-hmm. actually trying out for individual positions.
Like, can you give me a description? What do you mean by that? Individual positions? Like what?
Sure. So let's take a popular game. Don mentioned League of Legends.
Yeah.
So that's a good example there. League of Legends has five distinct roles that players may play in the game. One of the roles is a support role where you support the rest of your team by taking actions to help your team win, we have players that try out specifically for that role, and that's the role that they play. Very similar to you playing a particular position in basketball or football. Mm-hmm. You're not going to try out for other positions on the team. You're going to try out for the one that you've got the most experience with. It's very similar in gaming.
Don Marinelli, where do you see all this going? Is the sky the limit, or has the pandemic put it, you know, put the brakes on a little bit and taught us anything?
Well, I think the pandemic, if it's put the brakes on anything, it's the person to person. But as Nathan is indicating, and schools like, you know, University of Akron are showing, is that it's a grassroots movement from young people. So in that regard, I don't see it going anywhere. Probably one of the biggest concerns I have is that, unlike traditional sports, esports are run by the publishing houses, by the publishing companies. So, you know, whereas anybody can go to Dick's Sporting Goods and buy a football and go out and throw it around, or a soccer ball, if you want to play League of Legends, you've got to deal with the game publisher. You know, if you want to play Overwatch, you've got to basically, you know, work with Blizzard or Riot Games or Epic Games or that nature. Mm-hmm. So they really wholly control the product. And that's one of the vast differences from traditional sports.
Is there any parallel in your mind between that and like the NFL or the NBA or NHL for that matter?
Well, I think there is in terms of the governance bodies. I mean, you mentioned the National Association of Collegiate Esports. Mm-hmm. They are essentially a governing body that basically works with their 170 members saying, well, okay, this is what we expect in terms of recruitment. This is what we expect in terms of matriculation. This is what we expect in terms of grade point average and all that.
Uh-huh.
So as Nathan mentioned, it is in fact replicating traditional sports to that degree. And in fact, it is going to evolve. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that there are now professional teams. So you have Overwatch, which has the actual Overwatch League.
Right.
And that's comprised of, you know, regional franchises. Now, granted, the first year of the regional franchise was sort of a joke that we're all based in Irvine, California, and Southern California. But increasingly, you know, you're finding, like with the NBA, NBA 2K is the esports version of basketball. And in that regard, the professional teams are, in fact, based in their city. So it is, in fact, replicating traditional sports. And it's going to. And eventually, there'll be a players' union of esports players that will make demands, you know, on the franchises, on the teams. It'll be interesting to see where that goes and how it's handled.
And Nathan Meeker, what about, you know, Don Marinelli was telling us about how, you know, Staples Center sold out faster than ever. What's the audience for collegiate esports?
So right now, the audience for collegiate esports is really just esports fans, and then folks that are on campus at these different colleges that care about gaming and esports.
Uh-huh.
However, that is changing. As Don mentioned, you know, it's young right now, and the fact that you've got students that are in middle school, high school, growing up and watching these regional teams or now regional schools compete in these games, it's driving more fandom to the sport, to the game. So I do believe that will change here in coming years as fans who grow up seeing it as a competition get older and go into college, graduate from college, and then are able to cheer for those fan bases at either the collegiate level or the regional level.
Uh-huh.
as they get older, and when they would typically enjoy normal sports, they'd probably be doing the same thing with esports.
You know, and Don Marinelli, any thoughts about identifying gaming as a quote-unquote sport?
I really don't have any problem with that. And I mean, the interesting thing, and you know, Nathan can contribute to this, is as esports become established in colleges and universities, a big issue becomes, well, where are they going to reside? And there's been pushback from the athletic department of a number of colleges and universities who don't consider it to be a sport. In that regard, then they end up in, say, student affairs or you know, recreation or campus recreation or things like that. So there is pushback. But when you really break it down, I mean, there's incredible manual dexterity involved. I really don't think the audience that isn't into esports realizes the complexity of these games and what's required of someone to play them. You know, I like to point out one of the metrics that's used to determine how good a game is, and it's called actions per minute. And it's very common in a good esport competition for there to be anywhere from 400 to 600 actions per minute. Now, when I first heard that, I almost fell on the floor. You know, I remember mm-hmm. telling my friend, my Korean friend, well, gee, my favorite sport is baseball. If there's one action per minute, I'm ready to celebrate. I mean, so what mindset?
Thank goodness for beer and pot dogs, yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, the ability to absorb and understand that many actions per minute is probably one of the reasons why the U.S. military is doing a lot of recruitment and sponsorship of esports, because in, you know, the high tech service that we have today, who's better able to manipulate a drone or a spaceship than someone who's able to master an esport?
Yeah, now you're making me think of the last Starfighter now. So there you go. We are out of time, but Nathan Meeker, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Nathan Meeker is the director of esports at the University of Akron. And Don Marinelli, thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And keep up the good work, Nathan.
Don Marinelli is a visiting professor at Arizona State. He wrote about esports and the pandemic in Slate last month. We'll try to get a link to that for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So we have more Tech Tuesday coming up. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 4 weeks this summer, the number of acres in California torched by wildfires surpassed the record set in all of 2018. 4 million acres have been lost this year to increasingly hot and large fires. Journalist and author Daniel Duane wrote the November cover story of Wired on the changing nature of fire and how technology is being used to fight it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, let's set the stage. I want to talk about the technology, but we need to understand the fires. We were going to hear a TV news announcer describing a firenado or a tornado of fire. This was once a rare and dangerous phenomenon. It's becoming more common. Why is that?
Well, it has to do with the, again, with the changing nature of fire, in the sense that an increasing number of fires in the American West in particular are burning so hot and at such high sustained release of heat and energy over time that they are starting to interact with the atmosphere in somewhat novel ways, so that we're getting feedback loops between the heat of the burn, local winds, the heat changing the winds changing the heat, and that combination producing these really terrifying.
What do we know about why they're getting so much hotter? Why they're getting to the point where they're interacting with the atmosphere?
Well, it seems to be an intersection of two things. So, an intersection of climate change and what you might call, sort of wildland management. So the way we have taken care of our wildlands. So the climate change piece is a trend in the West toward hotter and particularly drier conditions, mm-hmm. and sort of longer hot, dry spells, so that, you can just imagine, like, if it's hot and dry for 2 weeks, but kind of only hot at night and cool, only hot during the day and cool at night, okay, so that bakes the dry fuel in the ground so much. If it's hot for twice as long and stays hot at night with very low relative humidity, that becomes a kind of kiln drying process for whatever fuels are on the ground. And then the fuels get to the wildland management piece of the puzzle, which is to say that we have had a kind of aversion all across the United States, but particularly in the American West. We've had a strong institutional and cultural aversion to let fires burn. You know, we've been living in Smokey the Bear's universe for 50, 75 years.
Right. I mean, the olden days before we were around, they just burned.
That's right. And in fact, indigenous Californians and indigenous people across the West deliberately set wildfires on a very regular basis in order to manage the nature of fire and manage for a particular kind of landscape that they really liked and that we would like to if we still had it.
What is the difference between surface-driven fires and plume-driven fires?
Yeah, so this is the big distinction. So, you know, you can think of surface-driven just meaning fires that are driven by, you know, move as a result of conditions on the ground. So those would include just whatever the ambient wind happens to be that day. The slope of the ground, fires like to climb uphill for the simple reason that heat rises. And what the fuels are in the ground. So are we talking about dry grass? Are we talking about manzanita? Are we talking about giant old growth trees? So those are surface conditions. And that is the, you know, most historically most wildfires, and even to this day in a sort of numerical terms, most wildfires are driven by conditions on the ground. This emerging and really scary phenomena is what is being called plume driven. So this is a fire in which the plume of heat and smoke arising from the fire itself becomes so big and so hot and begins to rise so fast into the upper atmosphere that it takes control of local weather conditions and begins to reorient winds in ways that actually feed the fire itself, as if the fire, once it becomes big enough, it finds a way to stoke itself. Mm-hmm. And that then drives the fire to grow faster, move in unpredictable ways, and become sort of much more destructive and frightening.
And your story compares the fires that we're talking about of today with the firebombing of Dresden in World War II. And what's the connection there?
Well, the connection there is that in the Second World War, the Allied Air Forces figured out that it's a lot easier to burn a city down than to blow it up. So they developed these, you know, sort of ways of doing that in which they figured out that what you need to do, I mean, it's really horrifying to read about. It's really awful. But, you know, they figured out that what you have to do is first send in waves of bombers with high explosives that do sort of blow up a whole part of the city and get it to fall down. And that punches holes in roofs and walls and all these things. Then you have a second wave of bombers fly over with incendiary bombs. So you knock it down, then you light it on fire. And that if you do that, you can sort of get a self-sustaining firestorm going. Well, this was done to cities all over, particularly all over Germany and mm-hmm. also in Japan. And these are really ghastly, you know, mass death events. But in a few of these, Allied war planners were surprised to see that it didn't happen every time, but sometimes the firestorm arising from these cities would generate this enormous plume of heat that would rise up into the air and take on the shape of like a giant thunderstorm. And it would generate these kind of howling inbound winds blowing directly into the plume itself. And a German reporter at the time, you know, just a newspaper reporter, coined this term firestorm. He saw one of these things. I think it was over Dresden. It could have been Hamburg.
Yeah,
and he said, that looks like a firestorm. So the research done during the Cold War, and so the Defense Nuclear Agency and then sort of a weird sort of branch of the Forest Service did a bunch of research during the Cold War trying to figure out, I mean, this is even more gruesome, but they were trying to figure out, gee, you know, that was kind of interesting how these firestorms arose. One of them arose over Hiroshima, for example. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, they ended up sort of saying, well, God, how could we make that happen on purpose? We should try to make that. That was kind of amazing. And they figured out that they basically ended up figuring out sort of the, you know, the, that these firestorms sometimes also arose in wildland settings. You know, that wildfires would sometimes generate these firestorms that were very similar to what had happened over Hiroshima, say, after the dropping of the atomic bomb. And so fire behavior scientists in starting in about the, you know, starting in the 1990s, early 2000s, in trying to make sense of some of these really frightening emerging wildfire behaviors, ended up kind of looking back to this Cold War period research on the firestorms of the Second World War, if that makes sense, to say, you know, to sort of understand the physics of how these giant firestorms work.
So how did understanding those storms of fire inform firefighters in the United States with these wildfires? I mean, how did it change how we counter them?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's sort of the key question here in a way. Okay, so imagine if you're, you know, if you're in the, you know, you work for the Forest Service and it's the 1950s and you've got all these, you know, tens of millions of acres all over the United States of forests you're supposed to take care of, and you've been, you know, and the sort of the mandate of your agency is, hey, fire's bad, you know, trees are fiber, we can't let fires run wild and destroy all that lumber and paper, we got to put them all out. Well, you want to have some kind of tool for figuring out when a wildfire does light, which way is it going to burn, so we can send firefighting resources to the right place. So starting in the 70s, Forest Service researchers sort of started doing, you know, lighting fires in labs and doing the math, and they figured out sort of a mathematics for explaining what happens in surface-driven fire. So because that was just the kind they were observing, it was the kind they were most aware of. So what, how fast will a fire, you know, so sort of basically math that allowed you to say, hey, we just had a wildfire light in this spot on this map, the slope of the ground goes this way, here's what the wind's doing, how fast and in what direction is it likely to go? Mm-hmm. So, you know, eventually that there were supercomputer versions of that, and then there were handheld calculator versions and PC versions, and there are sort of, to this day, there is a whole kind of fire behavior modeling framework based on those early mathematics that lives in software tools that firefighting agencies can use for just the purpose I described. You know, hey, a fire just broke out in this canyon, and it's much more sophisticated now. Let's plug in GIS map data and what we know about the fuels on the ground, and we've got a little more sophisticated understanding of wind. It'll tell us which way the fire is going to move. And that allows us to, you know, put our response here and evacuate that subdivision before that subdivision. And then there's another sort of piece of that, which is the same kind of software in sort of different iterations, can be used to say, hey, we're getting more and more scary fires. Can we predict the fires of the future? Mm-hmm. Where are we most likely to have really big burns? And can we direct some of our resources toward those places? So that's the... The problem we're having is that these, you know, increasingly our really gigantic, really destructive burns are very severe burns in the American West, like the one that destroyed the town of Paradise a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And there have been a couple this year. They either are not surface driven, so they're plume driven, okay, you know, driven by these weird interactions with the atmosphere, mm-hmm, or they kind of are surface driven, but our surface driven fire behavior models can't capture some of the really weird, complicated wind dynamics that are happening that are driving them. So we need, and you know, the whole sort of world of fire science right now is working on, a whole new generation of fire behavior models that can capture what's actually happening.
And what are the factors that they're adding to that that make them different?
Yeah. So the, you know, they're the two big ones. One of the biggest is those old surface driven. The biggest issue is that those old surface driven models had no way to account for interactions between the fire and the Earth's atmosphere. So they had no way to account for what happens when all that heat released by a fire goes up into the air and starts to change what the air itself is doing in ways that then, you know, change the wind direction, and then that change of wind direction feeds back into the fire. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have any way to account for feedback loops between ground fire and atmosphere. The other thing they didn't have, so that's a big piece of mm-hmm. where ongoing research is. Another thing they didn't have any way to account for was the changing nature of fuel conditions, which is to say, you know, the fire fuel, the wood, the leaves, the twigs, the stuff that's on the ground. Mm-hmm. All over the American West, we have, you know, we used to let fires, well, let's just say the sort of historical way, pre-historical way that wildfire typically burned in the American West was, you know, like fires in forests in California evolved to burn about once every 10 or 20 years. So every 10 or 20 years, and sometimes more frequently, a fire would rip through a forest, but because there was pretty regular fire, there just wasn't that much fuel built up on the ground. What was on the ground was dry grass and twigs. Mm-hmm. So the fire would just kind of rip quickly through that light stuff on the ground, and it would never really get hot enough to ignite the big mature trees.
Okay.
It would therefore tend to move as kind of a shallow band of flames. You can think of it as instead of a whole battalion of soldiers moving kind of as a big blob, you can mm-hmm. think of it as a battalion of soldiers standing shoulder to shoulder.
And I can visualize that. I've seen pictures of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sort of marching, you know, in the same direction together as this shallow band. Well, what has happened to our fuels is that because we have forbidden fire, in essence, have gotten so good at putting out fires all over the American West, the fuel beds, the heaped up dry stuff on the floors of our forests have become so deep and so thick with so many different kinds of fuel that when that flame front rips through, mm-hmm. it's not just a shallow band. It ignites a whole area, and that whole area keeps burning and gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And then that is really the phenomenon that generates enough heat to sort of take control of the plume and the weather and all these things. So that's the other big piece that, that has to be modeled, is how do we account for this heat engine being generated by these?
And this all makes perfect sense to me, that it needs to be modeled so that going forward, we can use that modeling in ways that deal with these new fires. How has the firefighting industry, the world of firefighting, adapted to using the new tech tools? How's it working?
They're not really available yet, is the truth. They're sort of just coming online now.
Okay.
You know, firefighting, my understanding of this is that, you know, the women and men who run firefighting agencies and run firefighting units, you know, through long years of experiences and careers, they've gotten very good at using the existing software tools. But also just in the way of most human endeavor, they've also gotten good at trusting their own instincts. Hmm. You know, so the sense I get is that, you know, the really good firefighters, firefighting agencies and fire managers have gotten good at saying, okay, well, I just know that the model I got right now is not going to do me any good in the kinds of winds I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. So I need to go with my own gut, which is telling me X, Y, and Z. But this is the kind of research that was moving along, the research to solve this problem was moving on at, it's probably not fair to call it a leisurely pace, but, you know, plugging away. These are very complex problems,
sure.
Scientific problems. Until a couple of years ago, when the 2018 fire season was so horrifically destructive, that's when we had that fire tornado in Redding, California. That's when the city of Paradise burned down. All of a sudden, the state of California, giant international reinsurance companies are saying, wow, this is really getting out of control. We got to do something about this. The scientific initiatives have kind of accelerated, but I very clearly get the sense that this season has, you know, just like the last month or two, has led to an even greater sense of urgency and acceleration in these research projects of saying, hey, we got to roll these tools out faster.
What are they studying at that grain silo in Montana?
Yeah, so the grain silo, or just this giant structure the size of a grain silo.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is at the Rocky Mountain Research Station of the National Forest Service. And there's a researcher there named Mark Finney, who's one of the great minds in this area. And he has, over many years, you know, done a lot of these sort of laboratory experiments where you light, you know, they build like an actual pile of wood and light it on fire and see what it does. But that science has been limited by the size of fire that they can build and how well they can control it in a lab. One of the great challenges of doing good wildfire science and modeling it properly is that it's very hard to create. Wildfires are gigantic phenomena. It's very hard to create. They're gigantic phenomena happening in a complex universe. It's very hard to replicate that in a lab. Mm-hmm. So a step in that direction is the construction of, and I think my understanding is they're sort of just, you know, construction is sort of, I think the first, you know, shovels will hit ground like within the next month or something like that. But there's, you know, funding in place and plans in place to build a new burn chamber the size of a grain silo that will allow Mark Finney's lab in Montana, this is in Missoula, mm-hmm. to do burn experiments of really big, deep piles of fuel. So they can heap in there, you know, pine needles and leaves and twigs and fallen branches, and then maybe the giant logs like the thickness of a fallen live tree, and sort of pile all this stuff into the epic bonfire bed that is, you know, analogous to what exists out there in our forest right now, and then light that thing on fire and hit it with winds of various directions and speeds and moistures of various directions and speeds and see exactly how much energy it releases and in what kind of pattern.
And start new models from that.
Yeah, and the idea, if I understand it correctly, you know, sort of one hope for that would be that you could sort of create almost like a Minecraft voxel, you know, a sort of three-dimensional, a digital three-dimensional model of a wildfire fuel bed with kind of baked in functional fire physics, so that you could then, you know, tile a digital landscape, as it were, mm-hmm. with a particular fuel type in a simulation engine, right? And then, you know, ignite a fire somewhere and get the engine mm-hmm. to run a pretty accurate, you know, a simulation with pretty accurate physics for a very complex fire.
Well, Daniel Duane, I appreciate your time today talking about this. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, right on. Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate
it. You bet.
It.
Daniel Duane is a journalist and author. He wrote the cover story about the California wildfires for the November issue of Wired. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Move over Amazon Fire Stick, Roku, and Apple TV. Chromecast with Google TV has delivered an update that one reviewer described as, quote, everything you could ask for, and just in time for Prime binging. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly is here to tell us about that and more. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what makes the latest from Chromecast so much better?
They finally added a remote control, and
oh my!
I know that doesn't seem like a big deal.
Are you kidding me? Everything's remote now. They didn't have a remote control. You had to get up?
No. Okay. So here's the thing. The original design behind the Chromecast was for super nerdy people like me. You plug this thing into the back of the television, and you controlled everything from your phone. You open Netflix on your phone. You go to the episode you want. You hit the button, and it just shoots it over to the television and starts doing it. The idea was, genuinely awful people like myself never put our phones down, even when we're watching television. So why not just make the phone the remote control?
Right.
Because people like me have terrible impulse control issues. We don't know how to watch television and not scroll through Twitter at the same time. So that was the original design, was for people like me, who, again, it's just a bad habit that Google turned into
should
a product.
Should not be encouraged by Google.
Should not be encouraged. And so this was a thing that's been going on for a couple of years now. They've gotten a little more powerful. They've added some features. Meanwhile, the folks at Roku have been offering what is essentially the same service, but it's been considerably more popular over the last couple of years. And tons of research has come around to suggest that the biggest reason is because it comes with a remote control. You don't have to use a phone. You don't have to be particularly tech literate in order to use it. You pick it up and you push buttons on this really simple remote, and the Roku just accesses all of these streaming services.
Right.
And so Google is now taking that approach. They've simplified the user interface so that it is considerably easier for anyone to navigate. They can choose whatever software they want to stream from on this platform. That basically runs a little bit more like a television box than it did the streaming system that it was before. And it has this really nice, functional, small remote control I'm almost assuredly going to lose this thing at some point in the couch cushion.
It's very small.
It's not particularly big.
Yeah.
It's very small, and it comes in three different colors, which...
That's good.
Why, like, to the point where even the batteries in the controller... match the color of the outside, which I think was just a little over the top on Google's part. But that's,
someone likes matching outfits.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've just, you know, we're color coordinating everything now. It's very exciting. and so you've got a couple different choices here as far as your colors go. They're all very pastel-y looking to make them a little easier to find. But that's what this really comes down to, is that the Chromecast was already a really nice streaming service streaming box.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty inexpensive. It hid behind your television for, you know, 40 or 50 bucks. You could have this thing that just kind of did everything, including streaming for very high-end televisions and lower-end televisions alike. And now it has this remote control that makes it so that anyone can use it, and a new, you know, visual, you know, kind of interface that just makes it a lot easier to navigate. And when you put all those things together, it's a $50 system that I think is going to be a really significant seller for Google this holiday.
All right,
season.
So assuming everybody's got a remote control now, so they're all on kind of the same playing field, what makes Google so much better than Roku, for instance, which also has a remote control with little pictures of Netflix and Amazon Prime and all that stuff on it?
The remote control is very nice for Roku, but the interface is still a little on the complicated side. If you want to go through and you know, it comes with Netflix and Hulu and things like that out of the box, but if you want to add something else, it's still pretty complicated to go through the store and navigate all that stuff. A lot of them are not particularly fast. So I've seen a number of people get frequently frustrated with the idea of going through and installing something new just because it takes a while to do it.
Mm-hmm.
This system is fast. It's dead simple to use. The voice control that comes with it is very nice. You know, generally, this is everything that a Roku does, but faster and a little tiny bit smarter and just a little prettier.
Which you care about that.
That is definitely something that you know, plays into my recommendation for this over a Roku system. The Roku systems, they're not particularly attractive. They're, you know, the system is a little complicated. And, you know, the Roku platform in and of itself just hasn't grown a ton in the last year, whereas mm-hmm. Google seems very heavily invested in this. And that's something that that is worth paying attention to if you want something that's going to last for a couple of years.
The review says that the main goal of Google TV is to heavily emphasize personalized and recommended content, meaning that they're paying very close attention to what you do watch.
This is something that Google and Apple in particular both have been promising as a feature for, I think, 5 years now, where both of these services, the whole idea was, you know, you can go into Netflix and Netflix will say, hey, you watch this thing. Now you'll like these things. Mm-hmm. But once you leave Netflix, those recommendations don't follow you anywhere.
Right.
Because that's Netflix's data. Like Netflix earned that data by getting you to watch Stranger Things 900 times. So, you know, by having that information locked down to Netflix, it doesn't impact the rest of the system. Google is trying really hard to get Netflix and Hulu and these other platforms to share some of that information in order to create this single recommendation hub, where you can say you really like Stranger Things and you trend a little more towards adult content. Let me recommend to you The Boys on Amazon Prime and have that show up in kind of the main screen instead of in between these things, which is something that is going to appeal to people who just that they're just not tied to one particular platform. Like if you only ever watch things on Netflix, this may not be a feature that you care about too much because Netflix is already doing that recommendation thing. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of evidence that says that most people are paying for about three streaming services now, right. between two and three streaming services. And so being able to recommend things across those services is of great benefit to Google by being able to kind of offer that layer on top that makes sense. And it has to work. It's worth pointing out that, like I said, Google and Apple have both been trying to offer this feature for quite a while now, and neither of them have been overwhelmingly successful.
All right, you brought it up. When's Stranger Things coming back?
I think it's coming... Isn't it?
Is it going to be around
November,
Christmas?
I think?
Gosh.
No, I don't think it's on Christmas. I think it's November. I think it's coming back on November. I could very well be wrong about
that. Well, they like holidays. Last time it was around Halloween. I just think those kids are all going to be grown up. So HP has made a convertible laptop for $1,200. What do we mean by a convertible laptop?
Yeah, so HP has had this definition of a convertible laptop for a little while now, and it basically means a laptop that you can flip around on itself to be a tablet when you want it to be.
Okay.
So you can kind of make the keyboard go away by folding it behind it. And this is, HP has put a lot of money into making sure that the screen is just really, really nice on this laptop. So if you take a look at it, there's almost no edge around the screen. The camera is kind of hidden down towards the bottom. And it has a really great resolution and color output. But the big thing here is that the actual dimensions of the laptop are 3x2 instead of 16x9. And those are a bizarre set of number combinations to mean that it's not an ultra wide screen laptop. It's not like a squat wide screen laptop. It has a slightly taller screen than you would get from your average laptop. It's designed to fit more information from top to bottom on the page instead of from left to right.
Okay, interesting. You find that useful?
This is a design that we've seen. Yeah, it's a design that we've seen Google and several other companies go with over the last little while. It means that you can see more of a website or more of a document on the page when you go to pull it up instead of having to do more scrolling. It means that you can fit more things vertically on the page. Uh-huh. And honestly, you know, I think with a lot of companies having that wide monitor on a laptop often means that the keyboard has to be wide, and that makes it a little uncomfortable for typing. So this makes it more of a traditional keyboard on the laptop, which makes typing a little better. And obviously, the screen on this thing is going to be the primary focus for HP.
And battery life is pretty long.
Battery life, this is actually something that HP has done really well with, is making these super light laptops that have had batteries that will last at least 10 hours. And this continues in that trend where they're promising anywhere between 10 and 12 hours on a single charge, assuming you're not doing, you know, ridiculously heavy gameplay or photo editing or something like that. But yeah, the big focus there is that even with this nice screen, the battery is going to last you what they call all day.
We only have 2 minutes left, Russell. Can you talk about how filters might not be all fun and games? What's the deal? Can we do a rush job on this?
Yeah. So Samsung and LG and a bunch of other companies, when you first open up a phone from those companies and you go to take a selfie, there's this beautification mode that's enabled. It's a big thing in Korea and Asia and a lot of places where it automatically adds filters to smooth your skin and to shape your face a little bit. And your phone is lying to you and telling you that your face is physically a different shape than it is.
Right.
And Google has made some efforts in its latest camera software to actually let you know what changes are being made and let you know that these beautification things are artificial because, you know, people are generally, pretty. They don't actually need software to make them prettier. To do this, Google is kind of reaching out and saying, you know, this is actually kind of unhealthy to have all of these filters to, you know, define what it is that you look like. So you could use them if you want to. They are off by default. But Google's kind of trying to take a more holistic approach to people using selfie mode to, be maybe less narcissistic or something.
Yeah, I'm going to have to talk about this more. Because I noticed with Zoom, they do a pretty mode. They fix you up.
Yeah.
And I love it. But I know it's fake, so I have to get over that. I have to go back and look in the mirror after every Zoom session. Russell, Holly, thank you so much for your time today, as usual. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.